I want to start off with LG promising to ship their AirPlay 2 and HomeKit TVs next week, so like the beginning of August. I think that means firmware updates to 2019 TVs, and I don't think there's maybe support for 2018, but like nothing before that. And this is where you can send audio and video to your LG smart TV that's compatible from your any AirPlay compatible device, you know, like an iPhone, iPad, Mac, or HomePod if you want to send audio without an Apple TV for the first time. And well, now it's the second time because Samsung got here first. But Samsung has the Apple TV app built in. LG won't, but yeah, they will in the future. And LG has HomeKit built in, which is a first for a shipping product.
Yeah, because right? Like Vizio and some other companies have HomeKit and stuff in beta, but LG, if assuming it does actually come out next week, they would be the first ones to do it because the Samsung TVs were technically first off the line, but they don't have any HomeKit support at all.
Yeah, and kind of feeling out that $299, $300 Samsung TV with AirPlay 2 in the Apple TV app, I've been in contact with Samsung's kind of PR to people, and even though I bought the TV myself, I asked, I was like, you know, trying to get a statement on the absence of HomeKit, and I thought maybe it was just like some weird negotiation where, you know, they got the TV app first, but they didn't do HomeKit, and maybe they'll do HomeKit in the future, but it's just some weird negotiation. But they didn't say this, but from what they told me, it seems like kind of reading in between the lines, that because Samsung owns SmartThings, which is like an acquired smart home platform that they bought years ago, I think they just didn't want HomeKit, and they think that SmartThings, which looks like the iOS app, looks just like the Home app. They think that's the way to go because it works with all of their Samsung products. And so whereas HomeKit is like one smart home platform to group different brands from like all different accessory makers into one app for let them all work together, I think Samsung doesn't want to do that when they had the opportunity and they just want you to use SmartThings home accessories, which does include like different types of accessories in HomeKit, like washers and dryers, for example. But it's kind of lame though that they're not doing HomeKit, and it doesn't. It seems to be because they don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, promoting their own over anything else, you can't really be too complaining about that, given that you're coming from the stance of, you know, Apple Incorporated, who doesn't support any other home platform apart from their own either. So, you know, it just depends which angle you look from. Of course, I'm pretty sure down the road, if Samsung changed their mind, they could just push out another software update and get back in. So it's probably one of those things where, you know, they're going to try and make their own platform not become marginalized and, you know, fade into irrelevance. But, you know, they can relent if they really have to. Yeah, and they might be pressured into by the addition of, you know, Sony and LG and Vizio and these other manufacturers doing it.
Yeah, and because it's going to be the case that even though Samsung is the only place where you can get the TV app right now, you can't get HomeKit, but we believe that LG, Vizio, and Sony will have the TV app in the future because it's also coming to Amazon Fire TV boxes and sticks and lots of places. So
Roku,
which is big...
The website, the like Apple TV website, just it says Apple TV app available on Samsung TVs and coming soon to LG, Vizio, and, you know, and the rest. So it's definitely on like the roadmap. It was just kind of weird how, you remember back at like CES, Samsung got the like clearly got some kind of exclusive to announce it first, and back then it was still called like iTunes TV shows and movies.
Yeah,
and then by the time the service, you know, actually got formally announced, it changed to the it morphed into the TV app. Mm-hmm. But it was just like a weird exclusivity period where they got to announce it first, but and it's shipping. I guess Apple just worked with them first, and then they decided to, you know, do everyone else as well, and that's just where this weird like time lag has come from.
Even with that like exclusive announcement, they were like 24 hours before LG could announce or Vizio. Like I think that was partly because of just the CES schedule when they had their major events. And like Sony might have been like one of the last to come, but it was like every next day there was one more company added until they ran out of companies. So I'm hopeful that when after some time on the market, if they want to stay competitive with each other, they just all want to check that box of having all three features, that will happen. Surely it will, because it doesn't seem like it's a limitation other than just their choice. So yeah, like Samsung Smart Things, they bought that. It was an existing brand, and then they built it into their stuff, like just like how they did. They bought Bixby to make their voice assistant. And I think it's fine if you like you only have Samsung products, but that's not super common, I think. So I don't know. We've got some big software updates to talk about this week. iOS 12.4 is out of beta after like 8 releases or 7 releases. It was a lot. There was one headline where I read about the 6th beta version, and I think I said, hopefully final in the headline, in parentheses. It wasn't. and watchOS 5.3 is out of beta. And you also get an update to macOS Mojave. I forget the version number, and tvOS 12.4 is out. But let's start with talking about what's going on with the watchOS 5.3 update, because through a combination of watchOS 5.3 and iOS 12.4, they fixed the walkie-talkie issue. They changed the batteries and now it works.
Yeah, they said they identified a security problem and then they obviously rolled out the fix. It was a week and a few days and change since it was originally taken down. So definitely one of the longest outages of an Apple service in a while. The group FaceTime bug lasted about a week before Apple got a fix out for that. But, you know, that's kind of different. In A, it was, you know, a short period by 4 days. Plus, it was only part of the feature. Like, they didn't have to take down the entire FaceTime to get that, you know, to get the fix worked on. Whereas for walkie-talkie, obviously, they, you know, the app wouldn't work. And the app wouldn't tell you that it was down because of a security problem or anything like that. It would just act like the other person was unavailable. So it just say the other person is not available this time or connection failed. And so I bet that Apple support channels got quite a lot of like angry people who, you know, buying watches and trying this feature out and just like confused about why it didn't work. But at least they've come back and, you know, sorted it now.
Yeah. Like, so I think I mentioned last week that my brother-in-law has an Apple Watch now, and his wife, my sister, already had one. And, so he was trying to, like, he was just going through what control center, what was all there. And he was looking at walkie talkie and was like, oh, what's that? And I told him, and I mentioned, like, it's down, but then they still tried to try it. And I don't think they quite understood what I meant by, like, there's a security problem and it's literally turned off right now. Because, like, a few days later, he called me and said, hey, I'm trying to set up the walkie talkie with your sister, and it says she doesn't have an Apple Watch. and what's going on? We've been trying this for over an hour now. And I was like, oh, that's what I was telling you about. It's still down because of a security flaw. So then the moment that we confirmed that it was going to be fixed, I said, go update your phone and your watch. It will now work. So there was at least two people affected by that outage. And through that outage, they added the walkie-talkie to the system features services page where you can check is a service down or not. So through that error, it got promoted to be a service of its own. Also new in the Apple Watch is the ECG, or the electrocardiogram app. It's now available in Canada and Singapore. So that's more and more countries added to. First, it was just the US. Then they had this massive wave after the UK and other countries.
Europe, yeah.
Yeah, now it's in lots of places. I won't say everywhere because I'm sure there's still more, but at least two more. So back closer.
I'm pleasantly surprised with this deployment. When they first unveiled the ECG stuff and made it US exclusive in the end of last year, I was kind of strapping in for like an Apple Pay Cash scenario where no other country gets it for, you know, what feels like eons. But it's actually been much quicker than I think all of us kind of expected. Like by the middle of 2019, they've got it in, you know, but most major markets, maybe not like China and stuff, but pretty big areas, like all of Europe, essentially. I would not have. I was happily expecting to wait until, well, not happily, but I was ready to wait till like the next generation hardware even came out before it like hit the UK. But it was actually a lot sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it wasn't even in the US on the day of the Series 4 launch. Like, it took about a month or so, I think, for you to have a software update to add ECG. I think it was in like 5.1 or 5.2. So. That would further suggest that it won't be around the country, around the world anytime soon. And then sure enough, here we are. It's in lots of places. And there was also that Ming-Chi Kuo report that mentioned two features for the Series 5 this year. One feature being the option of ceramic again, in addition to aluminum and stainless steel, which was gone in Series 4. And then more countries for the ECG. And that's already happened through this hardware. So now we're down to one rumor for the Series 5.
Yeah. And of course, the Kuo report said updates to the Apple Watch this year are this and this. It did not like specify Series 5 or anything particular. Correct. So there's still the chance that the ceramic model is just, you know, a different colorway option essentially to the Series 4 lineup.
Yeah. By the way, if that happens, if it's just, well, I'm not going to say I won't buy it. But if it happens, that would at least be 2 years in a row where I plan to get a new ceramic watch, and there's not a new ceramic watch. Because series 2 and 3, you had a white ceramic, and then series 3 had a gray ceramic as well. And then so by series 4, I was like, oh, it's a new design. It looks awesome. I'm going to get the ceramic one because this is a great Apple Watch. And they didn't do ceramic. And now I plan to get it for the Series 5. But if it's literally like not a Series 5, it's just the Series 4 now in ceramic, I may buy it, but it'll be not the new watch. It'll just be a new color. So, I'll say new in the software updates this week. HomePod gets the perfectly named HomePod 12.4 update. That's the latest software for the HomePod. And what's new there is you get language support for Japan and Taiwan. Is this tied to HomePod debuting in those countries as well, or coming soon to those countries as an item?
Yeah,
that you can purchase?
It's definitely launching in Japan and Taiwan soon.
Yeah. So this is similar to what we saw with China, where you saw Chinese language support added before you got the hardware available in the country. So that makes sense. And then let's talk about News Plus. So there's... In the release notes, News Plus gets mentioned. That's the paid version of Apple News, where you have access to magazines and newspapers and select online subscriptions. So what's changed with News Plus in this update?
Yeah, obviously this is with the context of those kind of murmurings that the News Plus launch didn't go very well. Customers were confused about what to do. Apple was talking to publications about, you know, different issues and problems they were having, and trying to inspire faith that the format would work. We obviously talked about the press release a few weeks ago where Q was like, we have hundreds of engineers and designers and everyone else working to make News Plus the best reading experience ever. And this is one of their services that they're heralding at the moment. They definitely want it to be a success. And because it is, you know, so inextricably connected to their finances, it is getting pretty regular updates. Obviously, we saw regular minor updates, I should say, at least, because with the 12.3 release, they added like the following buttons, which made it, you know, a lot easier to actually follow a magazine that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. And now with 12.4, there's a few different changes. All of these things are so obvious they should have been done from the beginning. Like, it just kind of highlights how much Apple like fumbled the News Plus launch, and I'm sure they know that internally now. They just, I don't know why it came out in the way it did, but hey, that's what happened. Because one of the changes they've made now is that all of the things you can access in News Plus are actually listed in the catalog. So in News Plus, there's an A to Z list of things that you can read. But until 12.4, all that was in that list was the magazines. Mm-hmm. And obviously, News Plus also includes like newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. And it includes like digital subscriptions, like the TechCrunch one, Extra Crunch, and Vice, I think, and a couple of others. Well, you know, until basically this week, it was nigh impossible to find or access those things, because unless they were presented to you algorithmically as like a suggestion, your News Plus tab would basically pretend like those things didn't exist. Because it is especially an issue when News Plus first came out, is everyone was like, well, how do I actually find the Wall Street Journal stories, right? Mm-hmm. And you either had to like, you know, dig it out and search for yourself, at which point you'd then have to like, find the free stories, then find the paid stories and dig down there, or search for an individual article, or wait for, you know, one of the suggested articles to be shown to you. Now it's a, you know, a lot simpler for a new customer that's coming to the service. They can go on the list of everything and actually see everything. So if you scroll down now in that A to Z list, you can actually find the Wall Street Journal and subscribe to it. Because mm-hmm. before, the A to Z catalog was essentially like ripped straight out of Texture, it seemed like.
Yeah.
So they hadn't, you know, adjusted it for the content offering that they actually launched News Plus with. It seems like all of this stuff with the digital subscriptions and the newspaper deals, that all happened like so last minute. When the software came out, it just didn't acknowledge those in any good way at all. It was like minimum viable functionality taken to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
They've also added, there's now a better section in the My Magazines area, which can show you all your downloaded issues. Again, before, either by like laziness or by design, they try to make there'd be no distinction between downloading and just reading, right? Yeah. It was kind of just like, you favorite your things you want to see, and we'll automatically make sure that they're downloaded for you, right? You know, however well those algorithms work is a huge problem. And it was just confusing from a UI perspective. Like, do I actually have these things ready if I actually do want to go, you know, on a plane for 9 hours and read this stuff? So now, you know, they more clearly show you what you've actually downloaded in your My Magazine section, both your offline and your online content. And there's actually now a way to delete downloaded magazine issues. If you go to the history, there's like a clear button. Before, it would automatically remove them. Yeah. And we know how well like that kind of stuff works from, you know, optimized storage and like a photo. So you need, now at least there's like a at least a one button that you can actually clear some stuff outwards if you do want to reclaim some space.
Yeah. What's the story country on News Plus so far? It's US.
US and Canada.
And Canada. And then coming by the end of the year or soon or yeah, then later?
By the end of the year. They said in the fall for the UK.
Yeah.
And so, a few other markets to come.
I think, okay. Yeah. So everyone probably remembers News Plus launched after the March 25th event, and everyone got, or everyone who has access to the service received a 1 month free trial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and it's priced at $10 per month. And that one price also applies to family sharing. So you can share with, you can have your service plus share with five other members of your family, the family sharing at no additional cost. And everyone has their own magazines, subscriptions, and they have access to everything. And it's all personalized to the user. So I canceled News Plus 100% before the trial ended. I did not like the experience. It was clearly lacking. I mean, we did an episode about this, so you can hear the initial thoughts on that there. But there, at some point, I think it was after WWDC or so, I was just thinking, there's some new changes to News Plus, and I kind of need to check them out for work purposes. Like as it clearly continues to evolve with every iOS update. So maybe I can justify it as it's a business expense, and so it's a write-off. And let me just do 1 month of News Plus and see if, you know, personally I enjoy it again. And the first month came and went, and I think I may have like poked around a few times, but I didn't read much. and then I got the auto-renew email, and it was like, oh, you paid for another month. And I was like, well, now I'm $20 into this thing, so this month I'm going to get my $20 worth. And so I put in kind of the effort that you'd do if you really were enthusiastic about the service. And I, you know, favored it a bunch of service magazines and publications that I'd like. And I made sure that on the weekends, on like Sunday evening, I'd spend time kind of reading things that I'd put off until the weekend. And I have to say, like, now I'm not going to cancel it immediately. I know it's rare that you hear people enjoy News Plus at a level that you want to pay for. But the family sharing thing is interesting because it's no additional cost. And as long as, you know, someone's enjoying it, that's interesting. But my go-to magazine is Runner's World in this, and they only publish every other month. So six issues a month. So that's tough sell. But it's easier to find in News Plus than it is in a bookstore or grocery store around me for some reason. And I could do a subscription where they bring it to my home, but I haven't gone through that, and it'd be a better value for just that magazine. But I'm kind of aspirationally, I've added a number of magazines that I would also kind of want to read if I've got the time. And so like I've got Men's Health saved, GQ, National Geographic, Parents, Car and Driver, Time, People, Smithsonian, because they had an interesting article about the Apollo 11, Man on the Moon story, New Yorker, Rolling Stone. And then just today when I was browsing to check out how you can now see Wall Street Journal and TechCrunch's Extra Crunch, Vox's publication, and LA Times, I've added Total Guitar. So this looks like a pretty good portfolio here. There are magazines that I would buy in the real world years ago that if they were here now, I would add them too. So I hope that part of this News Plus story is that they add more publications than they already have for some reason, because there's some missing. But especially on an iPad, I get some enjoyment out of it. Not on the iPhone, and that's tricky because like the iPhone's where I'd be in a grocery store line and, you know, kind of casually browsing. But I've got enough to look at it in that grocery store line already. So yeah, I'm kind of coming around. I never look at it on the Mac or the iPhone either, but on the iPad, it's something to it. And it makes me use my iPad in different ways. So I'm on it.
Well,
right,
you don't
now.
Use in the Mac because the news app's terrible because it's in Japan.
I think it's
and
a lot
changed in Catalina.
I think it's largely about form factor and screen size. So the iPhone's a good form factor, but it's the wrong screen size. And the Mac is a great screen size, but it's the wrong form factor.
Yeah, and the iPhone suffers from the problem that there's still a lot of those magazines are just PDF scans. So
sure,
you have to zoom around and mess about with it. Whereas if they were all native like Apple News format, you'd at least get refillable text and stuff. So
Yeah,
more enjoyable mobile experience.
Yeah, I'm not in on News Plus in the same way that I am with Apple Music, where I can see no way out anytime soon. And then I'd lose value by not paying for it. I could easily just walk away and be done with it. There's no family tied up to it yet that I know of. So, and with Runner's World, they do online stories too that are only on the website, I guess. And so they're usually pretty clicky, so I usually save them to my reading list and then go back and try and catch up on reading those in Safari. And I'll often find them on social media, but then to actually read the story, you get a few free stories a month, but then you need to pay for Runner's World Plus or something like that, like a digital subscription to see those stories. And I'm kind of getting to a point where there's enough interesting things that I see saved that I can't read without paying for that. I'm at some point I'm going to look at, does it make more sense with time and money to just pay for both a paper and digital subscription to Runner's World and not News Plus, or both for work reasons, or whichever. So there's something I've got to think about, at least for money. There's a new transfer feature if you're upgrading your iPhone. So tell me about that in iOS 12.4.
Yeah, so this is basically branded as transferring directly from your phone, and it applies to when you have an existing phone, you're upgrading, you're swapping to a different model, and you want to get your data from your current phone to your next phone and carry on. And so up to now, you've been able to do a backup through iTunes, or you can do an iCloud backup and restore. This essentially offers an alternative method that does not need you to connect to a computer to use iTunes, and you don't have to use iCloud at all. It will use a kind of like a peer-to-peer network to directly send the data across from your current phone to the new phone. And it's basically integrated into the quick start process. So this has existed for a couple of OS versions now, where if it notices that if you're setting up a new phone on the Hello screens and it notices you've got, a phone nearby, it'll pop up and say, do you want to automatically transfer all your settings over and everything, blah, 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 blah. And you can press yes. And in prior to 12.4, all that would do is make it easier for you to do an iCloud restore, right? So it would transfer some settings and some stuff over locally, but then most of your data comes over through an iCloud restore.
Yeah, you mostly save time putting in your password.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, I think it does save encrypted passwords and stuff and, some keychain stuff but in general, it was doing an iCloud restore. Now, when you go through that same process, you can choose to either do an iCloud restore or you can use this transfer directly option, which will do the equivalent of an iTunes backup and restore, but just going straight over the network. Now, it can do it wirelessly using a peer-to-peer Wi-Fi network, or actually, if you plug in your phones together with a cable, it can actually do it wired as well. Given that the iPhones obviously are all Lightning, that Apple says to do this, you have to plug in the USB 3 camera adapter to one of the iPhones and then use a Lightning to USB cable to then plug that into the other phone.
There's got to be a transfer cable that Apple will have at their store only. Yeah. Not for sale, but for you.
Yeah, this feature in general seems like a big win for the retail environment. And I am sure that Apple stores will get given, direct cables, that they don't have to do, they don't have to go to Dongle Town. They can just use one, Lightning to Lightning cable. I would doubt that Apple would sell that same cable to, just on their website, because it's kind of a niche case anyway, but it definitely helps retail employees. And, for retail, not just Apple stores, but, carrier stores in general, where you go in and you trade in phones, you get a new one. Those staff hit so many issues where people don't have iCloud, or they have iCloud, but the storage is full, or the Wi-Fi is really slow and they don't want to be in the store for ages. So for those kind of use cases, being able to transfer directly is a big win. And I think it's good that you shouldn't be required to sign up for an iCloud subscription, even for a day, and then cancel it again just to move your phone over. Right, the whole process is you're paying Apple more money. Right, you're buying a new phone essentially. You want you're buying a new product from Apple, and up until 12.4, presuming you're in the perfect world of not owning a real computer anymore, your iCloud backup was predicated, and you have enough space in iCloud to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you did have the space, you'd go to the store, start doing the trading. Oh, I realize I haven't upgraded my iCloud. I haven't actually backed up in a week. Oh no, now I'm going to have to sit here for another 45 minutes while it does the full backup and then restore it down. That'll take another, half an hour or whatever. So being able to have like a direct peer-to-peer connection is a big boon for those use cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's 8 years since iOS 5 let you cut the cord for software updates, and that's a long time ago. I mean, that was 5 years into iOS. So it's such a small subtle feature, but if you've got the right hardware or you do it wirelessly, then it's going to be great for everybody, not just people in Apple stores upgrading their phones on slow Wi-Fi or crowded Wi-Fi. But it's only on the iPhone for now, right? Like, not on the iPads, as far as we know, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's not on iPad or iPod Touch.
Yeah, because on the iPad, you could theoretically have a lot more data because those go up to 1 terabyte now. And you could possibly have the right cord. You could have the right cable that's either USB-C to Lightning, which exists, or USB-C to USB-C. So those are two cables that don't require a goofy adapter made for cameras. but then the wireless part is probably what most people will do, and that still benefits to, I guess, you do you need Wi-Fi for that, or is it just like with AirDrop where it can be, as long as you're nearby in proximity, it can make it happen?
Right, so it's the same as a iTunes backup and restore, mm-hmm. which actually does still require the network for some things.
Okay.
For instance, when you restore apps, regardless of what backup you're doing, your backup file never includes the app binaries, because app binaries are like thinned and specialized for every device model. So if you were literally just transferring the files over, you'd have missing assets and resources. If you were going from like an iPhone 10 to a 10S Max, for instance, you'd be losing the 3X resolution assets. Sure. On the way.
Makes sense.
So those backups always download apps from the App Store. So you're not going to be like network free, but all of your data and stuff, if you're storing big documents in iCloud Drive, you can transfer all of that directly.
Okay, cool. And so, I mean, and this is definitely something that Tim Cook sort of hinted at in that letter when they missed their quarter. So it's delivery on that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of like coming back to the big hoo-ha from the beginning of the year when obviously Apple had the revenue guidance miss. And in that letter to investors, Tim Cook said one of the paragraphs was, one such initiative is making it simple to trade in a phone in our stores, finance the purchase over time, and get help transferring data from the current to the new phone. And now we're in, July? And it finally feels like they've actually wrapped up that sentence, because obviously they've been doing the trade-in promotions with the boosting trade-in values. They've rolled out iPhone financing. Now when you go on their website, everything's listed in dollars per month, right? Up front first, versus buying everything, as the sticker price of the mm-hmm. full hardware. And now, obviously, they have a viable in-store recovery and transfer option. Because, obviously, when you're doing trade-ins, they want to take your device off your hand and then come home. I actually saw a real bad horror story on Reddit a few months ago where someone had traded in their phone. They got a new phone, and the person in the shop, I don't know if it was an Apple store or somewhere else, had told them, don't worry, you can do an iCloud restore when you get home. And then they got home and they realized their iCloud backup hadn't been backed up for 2 weeks, and they just lost data, right? Because by that point, your physical phone has been lost into the ether. And yes, in a perfect world, you should be backed up in three different places on your devices. But, normal people just don't do that. If you're lucky, if they even have an iCloud backup, to be realistic.
Yeah. If you ever turn off iCloud backup or turn off your iCloud for some reason, then you can just toggle and forget about it. And there's no, you rarely get a reminder, hey, you haven't backed up in next many days. Like, you do eventually, but like 2 weeks can go by without that reminder. I think it's like 30 days might be the threshold. So it's possible. Yeah,
and especially if you're someone who's, doesn't want to pay and just keeps dismissing those alerts, and you just don't think about it when you buy a new phone, and that's a real sour spot. If you get home, you're like, wait, I've actually just lost all this stuff. That's just ridiculous.
Yep. And one thing we keep looking for in every beta update is Apple Card, the new credit card from Apple with Goldman Sachs as the backing bank. What do you get? Is it 5% off with an Apple Card transaction over Apple? 3%?
It's 3% at Apple, 2%
physical.
2% anywhere, and then 1% physical.
Okay. Yeah, I was making it way better than it was. Well, as we...
it's been so long, you've made the deal better in your head.
Yeah, I've applied interest to this, what they do, because they're taking so long. But the reporting on this has been that Apple employees in corporate were testing it, and then Apple retail employees around the world, or around the U.S. were testing it. And I think we might have got some information about how that works with employees. Like, I wondered, you know, is it real money that you're playing with? Is it, like, really affect your credit score if you're an employee and you can't get it or something like that? And I think what I heard was that if you're an employee, it is a real credit card. It's real money. Like, you're responsible for what you pay for. But you don't get a hit on your credit if you're not approved. Like I said, they've worked that out somehow. Which I wonder if that'll be for customers too. Probably not, but at least for retail employees, they somehow worked it out where it only hits your credit if you're approved and not if you're declined.
Yeah, and that was only for approval. Obviously, if you then got the card as an employee and got into loads of debt, that would still destroy your credit rating. But at least for the initial approval, they were getting like a, you know, a free pass basically.
Yeah. So we're still waiting. iOS 12.4 is out. I think it's quite possible that they could flip a switch at some point, and iOS 12.4 is the release for it. Yeah. I think 95Mac Ski Rambo, who we'll talk about more toward the end of the show, he shared with us that iOS 12.3 technically supported Apple Card. They're just waiting for the service to be ready. And there were lots of assets changed within the wallet app that show that it's still being worked on, it seems like. So maybe it's going to come at some random time, or maybe it'll be 12.5, but or 12.4.1, you know. It's sort of like how Apple Pay Cash didn't make the iOS, was it 10 release or 11 release? And then it was like
it was iOS 11, and then... Yeah. It was meant to be iOS 11.2. It was actually coming out with, but then iOS 11.2 was released, and Apple Pay Cash wasn't there, and then Apple Pay Cash got turned on server side like 5 days later.
Yeah. So might be another one of those situations. But the big kind of deadline, I mean, they say later this summer all the time, seems to be, well, is it going to be before iOS 13 in September? Which I think summer is to September 21st on the calendar. And we think like iOS 13 will be out maybe a week before that or so, or maybe 2 weeks before that. So it may, I mean, one thing is iOS 13 does drop devices. So there could still be an iOS 12 release that adds it to all the devices that get dropped that would support it. So we'll see when it comes out. I am waiting. You can't because you're in the UK.
Woohoo!
But I know our readers are interested, and it was kind of funny because, like in our coverage, we see when the beta is going to come out usually by about 45 minutes ahead of time. And so we, in our initial headline, it was like Apple Card expected, you know, not to say it's coming, but we do expect this to be the release. And then within moments of publishing that version of the story, we learn that it's probably not likely in this version, which turned out to be the case.
And yeah, it wasn't mentioned in the release, no.
Yeah, and so we reframed it from expected to Apple Card looms, launch looms. But there were bigger publications than us who posted only after the software update was released and then said it was in the software update. And it was just kind of hard to see. Like, I was confused. I was like, is this embargoed coverage that we didn't have from Apple? And they say it's going to be in the update. And then, you know, we're missing it because, let's be honest, we're all running iOS 13. And readers and listeners have asked, whenever Apple Card does come, will you be able to use it with iOS 13? And from what I can tell from what retail employees are saying, you can definitely sign up for it in 12 and then upgrade to 13 and it works. I've not seen anyone running the 13 beta sign up for it in 13, but surely Apple considers that when they release it, maybe, even if by a week they're off. But
yeah, I mean, it has to be in there by September, so
right, yeah.
It will be added to a seed at some point.
Yeah, so I bet it's already supported in 13. They just had to flip the switch server side to let you sign up for it. And I think it was you who told me that when you have no cards in the wallet app, is it no credit cards and debit cards, including Apple Pay Cash, Apple Cash is not called, that you'll see a promotion for Apple Card? Because otherwise,
right,
it's just a plus
button. So if you have a blank wallet with nothing in it at all, whether it's tickets, passes, cards, anything, there's that little like info box that pops up and it says, it basically explains what the wallet's app for, what the wallet app is for, right? Because otherwise you just enter this app and there's nothing there. And so it explains, oh, you know, you can add these cards, you can add a debit card for, or a credit card for contactless, or you can get these apps from the app store and, you know, get some wallet passes. And that's a little info box. And as soon as you add something, that goes away. My understanding is there will be another one of those boxes shown when Apple Card is released, as basically the banner ad for it, right? Yeah. So when you go into the wallet app, it'll have this little you know, like rounded rectangle for obviously people in the US, and it'll say sign up for Apple Card here, and you can press X and make it go away, or it'll be, you know, one button, and then that launches you into the application flow for the card.
So it probably won't be press the plus button every time there's an update, or you think it might be happening.
I don't think it goes through that plus button at all, actually.
Yeah, that's good.
The plus buttons, I think when you press the plus button, all that comes up is like enter your card number to add to Apple Pay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So unless they change that, I'm pretty sure it's only going to be pushed to you as like, you know, a little wallet card thing, little info box thing.
That makes sense. It's kind of spammy in one way, but it's also at least you don't tie it into that plus button, I guess. So, which is more hidden and would get in the way if you just want to add your, you know, own card.
It's not like Apple would add a new tab just called News Plus that doesn't go away if you don't use News Plus, or put a tab in the App Store to replace the updates button with their gaming subscription service. No spam like that comes out of this company.
No.
Maybe we'll even get a push notification for the Apple Card.
You can't dismiss until you take a shot at applying. All right, let's talk about a story that broke last week that we didn't quite make the cut for us, and it's the Apple Podcast report, I think by way of Bloomberg. So tell me what's in that report, and then we'll talk about what we think about it.
Yeah, so Bloomberg basically said that Apple is reaching out to media companies to discuss buying exclusive rights to podcasts and maybe funding some new shows as well. But that was basically the nugget of the story, then wrapped in, you know, five paragraphs worth of filler. Mm-hmm. So it does sound like it's still a very early initiative.
Yeah,
it's not like, oh, it's coming out at the end of the year or anything. It sounds like they're just getting the wheels in motion. They're putting out the feelers like, you know, how much are people going to want to fund this stuff? Are people going to give us the rights to these kind of shows? And we'll see how it goes from there. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any like strict details on what Apple intends to do, whether they're just going to release these podcasts for free, which honestly seems unlikely, whether they're going to make them, you know, as part of some additional subscription or whatever else.
The tech audience that we follow had one big reaction was, reading, I think way too into the early preliminary reporting. Everyone that I saw, or a lot of people who I saw, imagine this meaning Podcast Plus, like News Plus, as a paid version of the podcast experience. And then there will be podcast paywall behind that. Sometimes podcasts that exist today paywall because Apple wants to fund those, likely ad free, but then also those major mainstream podcasts would go back there too and not be on the Apple Podcast app for free. And I think we both have very different takes than that, than kind of what that nightmare scenario that a lot of people imagined is. What's your take? And I'll tell you mine as well.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, they're not. Obviously, firstly, you can address the problem of definitions, right? Like, you know, technically, a podcast is distributed by an RSS feed, and you can add it to any client that understands RSS. You know, blah 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 blah. But common garden people think of podcasts as like shows that they subscribe to.
Yeah, an audio show. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the audio show, although technically Apple Podcasts does support video. And if you ask like a Twitch audience, so you know the Twitch, like the video streaming website, the game streaming site, what a podcast is, they would say it's a video chat show basically that's streamed on Twitch. Because if you go on Twitch podcasts, you know, what they call a podcast, that's what they mean. They just mean like a different type of live stream where it's like an interview format basically.
Mm-hmm.
So even like audio only is a very like tech focused, you know, demographic. You could argue that, you know, half the content that's put on YouTube would be a podcast if it was just named that way, right? So the definition's wavy, but some kind of exclusive media content, right, that isn't text, I think is a I mean, some of the Apple TV Plus stuff could even theoretically be, you know, classed as a podcast if you really wanted to stretch it. So if you just put that word cloud in the air, I see this Apple's gonna do some exclusive shows. Probably not even existing shows. It will be like new stuff, kind of how they did with TV Plus, where it's like new and exclusive, right? Not seen elsewhere, that they can release inside the podcast app to make people want to use the podcast app. Maybe a couple of them will be free and exclusive to podcasts, but I assume there will definitely be a pay tier to this because Apple wants to make their money back. It seems unrealistic to me that Apple could support a, you know, Apple Podcast Plus $9.99 a month thing, like a direct corollary to, you know, to news. Maybe they could do one that was really cheap, like $2.99 a month, maybe, that could qualify. Because we still don't actually know yet what games and TV are going to cost. We just assume they're going to be $9.99, but maybe games could be $7.99. We don't actually know for sure yet. So maybe a podcast could have been like a small, like cookie-sized add-on. You know, it's $2.99. I think most likely it will probably be rolled into like an Apple Music subscription. Mm-hmm. And when you buy Apple Music, you also get these podcasts, and it cross-promotes in both apps, right? So when you sign up for Music Insider Music, you can also mention and access these exclusive podcasts as part of your service. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in the podcast app, it will let you in like the featured sections. I'm sure they'll promote their own exclusive shows, and when you actually go to listen to one, it'll be like, you need an Apple Music subscription to play this content.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you look at the wider market, it mirrors exactly what Spotify is doing, where Spotify is essentially turning their music app into a quasi podcast player as well, because in their case, they know that if they can get people playing podcasts, that means they're not spending money to the royalties of the music streaming, you know, the music streaming artists, labels, everything like that. So they show their own podcasts in the directory. Plus, they're also now investing, you know, millions of dollars into, you know, original shows with their acquisitions from yeah. So I see it as a direct argument, a direct corollary to what Spotify is doing. It's like, oh wait, we've got the biggest podcast service in the world, the biggest podcast app in the world. You know, maybe we should actually have some exclusive to cement our position and not just cede control to the competition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because for years, Apple has had and still has the biggest free podcast directory that any client can use, in reference and kind of mirror, or in Apple's and iTunes and the podcast apps way. It's the directory in that app. I cannot see Apple, even if they do ad free shows with like funding. I bet that funding a podcast is relatively cheap, and so I have a hard time imagining that they see that as a need to get, like, make their money back from it directly through selling podcast episodes. I know it's services era, but I just feel like paying for a podcast, like, you know, a season of a podcast versus a TV show, you know, it's gotta be just tiny. So I could see them wanting to have podcasts that you can only get through the Apple Podcast directory. Maybe I can see them doing, like, if you've got an Apple Music subscription, for no additional cost, you get access to some paywalled ones. But people have a really bad, you know, take on like paywalled podcast. So I don't know. But there are lots of places like Spotify doing those, The Athletic doing those, where you've got to pay for a service to get access to certain shows. But in Apple's case, like, they could even do ads for like Apple services and use that to make their money back and not do this as a paid thing. The Apple Music thing is like, it's hard for me to imagine them putting those shows in the music app, because that's just not good. You're like creeping back into the iTunes monolith. And to have a subscription to one app unlock something in another app is kind of clunky. I think, you know, like a $3 a month subscription is just unnecessary, even though they do I think the best example counterpoint to that is like iCloud storage, where they do 99 cents for what most people would be okay 50. With for free. Yeah. Yeah. 50 gigabytes.
And you could argue that doesn't cost them very much money.
Yeah.
That's right. They still want your money for it.
Yeah. That's a very good counterpoint. But for the podcast thing, I mean, it might just be enough to say, we've got shows that you cannot find on Spotify, so stick with our app. And it's only available in our app. There's no RSS feed for it, because right now the way podcasts work is you create the RSS feed on your own and then you submit that to Apple. They don't host it for you. These could be Apple hosted podcast feeds that there's no open RSS feed for, which classic podcast tech people would take issue with. It's not technically a podcast if it's that, but I mean, Apple podcast comes from Apple in the iPod.
Right, just think of all the podcasts in the world, right, that are mm-hmm. free, but then have a Patreon tier where you get bonus content, right?
Yeah.
And the bonus content is often audio content, and, you know, it's technically a podcast. It's just released through Patreon instead of actually in an RSS feed.
No, so. It's a secret RSS feed that you got to pay to get to. But
well, this is a secret RSS feed. It's just only available on podcasts. Like,
well, it might be no RSS feed. It's only available on Apple Podcasts.
But. Yeah, I think the technical, like, you know, the technorati of, oh, you have to be sticking to, you know, the RSS format from 20 years ago to qualify as a podcast is, mm-hmm. you know, it's clinging to straws of being like the old days, right? It's like complaining that, you know, Snapchat isn't available on the web, right? It's oh, nobody cares anymore if something's only available on an app, right? Or to, you know, to a lesser extent.
It's kind of iPad and computer, in a way.
Yeah. I feel like it's very much like a truck mentality. And yes, it would be nice if we could live in a world where everything was freely available and ad-supported, but, you know, it's just not going to happen. You already see everybody else doing it. It's not like Apple's leading the way here, right? And I don't think they care if, you know, the 10% slice of tech podcasts get a bit annoyed that they're doing stuff that isn't, you know, that deviates from a kind of informal standard anyway. Like, the RSS format itself isn't even like a strict rule from anyone, really. Yeah. It was just kind of like hacked together in a sense. And now that's the de facto way it happens. But, you know, Apple controls the directory for most people who access podcasts anyway, right? Like, technically, the way that you were meant to, you know, publish a podcast in the old days was you'd have the RSS feed on your website and someone would go and find the RSS feed and add it in. You know, that was clearly unfathomable and unrealistic. And so Apple did like a directory and it became the leading directory. And now that's what all podcast apps feed from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this stuff changes over time constantly. And I wouldn't get too hung up on that kind of thing.
Yeah. The thing is, with Apple investing your own money in podcasts, it's probably going to be the sort of super produced, very mainstream serial type, maybe This American Life type podcast, and not the kind of like hobbyist, even you know, that hopefully we're more professional than someone starting brand new for the first time. And maybe like a lot of tech podcasts that you listen to, tech people can be good at audio. But you know, we're still kind of at that like amateur level where it's not, you wouldn't hear it broadcast on the radio or on TV and adapted for TV.
Yeah, it's like script. A lot of the time, the well-produced stuff is all like pre-scripted and you know, has like, it was almost like writing a book and then reading it out, right?
I mean, it could be a TV show. You just want the video to it, but it would be like, you know, Ken Burns effect images and like, you know, B-roll tape running. But yeah, that's the kind of stuff I imagine them doing. Not the kind of things where Apple like takes a podcast that you like and the hosts get paid a lot of money and then that podcast goes away for free and it becomes behind a paywall. Like, I don't think it's anything. I think it's very unlikely that you see a podcast that exists today go behind a paywall, if there is one, or a podcast that exists today become a part of it unless it's like season 3 of a popular show only produced because Apple it's going to, you know, make it happen, or maybe like talent from an existing show. We like that person. Let's have them do something original for us. That's not what they were already doing. So I think this is all additive and nothing will go away in the process. That's my optimistic take at least.
Yeah. Just one quick thing. When you mentioned like ad supported content, right, from Apple, I don't think Apple's going to touch ad supported content with a barge pole anymore. Like, they at the March event, it was all stressing no ads, no tracking, and we've seen them try audio ad supported content before, like iTunes Radio, remember that had, you know, ads on it.
Beats One advertises for Apple stuff.
Yeah, originally they wanted like advertisements for other companies, right? They had like McDonald's sponsoring stuff, but all of that stuff fell away. You know, they got rid of iAd and all the radio stuff. And so I don't think Apple's going to touch advertising at all anymore. Like, they're done with that. They've expunged that from, you know, their entire ethos. Like, they want you to pay for it.
Yeah.
they're going to give it a value. They're going to try and push it on you. Maybe they'll bundle it up at some point in the future with other stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, they want you to buy it for a monthly fee.
Yeah, I think Beats One now is like product placement around Apple things, but not like directly. You know, this is that. But you on the radio, you do hear ads for Apple Music, which is always fun to listen to hear. Let's talk about some. We're going to get into the hardware rumors of the season. So we've got, I think, 3 different hardware categories to talk about. But first, let's talk about Intel and their modem business, which they're out of now. And Apple's interest in that. So what's the story there?
Yeah. Basically, we talked about this a few months ago when, you know, Apple settled with Qualcomm, Intel said they were done. So clearly, but at the same time, Apple's license lasts for like 6 years or whatever, and chip supply is a multi-year agreement, but that's going to expire at some point. Parallel to that, we have the constant rumors of Apple developing its own modems at some point because they don't want to rely on Qualcomm chips. even if they have to license their patents, they, you know, they want to use custom silicon at some point. Same process as what they did with, like, you know, the processors and the graphics chips in iOS devices. The report this week basically said that Apple is looking to buy the modem division off of Intel because, you know, now Intel's getting out of the business. They're trying to, like, salvage some money from it by selling it off to someone. Clearly, Apple's interested. And apparently, it's in the talks are in the realm of, like, $1 billion around that range. That would represent, you know, like, the second biggest acquisition that Apple's ever done after Beats Electronics, which was $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But it might even be a stretch to call an acquisition. It almost just might be like, you know, we're buying the patents. I think the closest analog, it was a company called Dialog, which produced, like, audio controller stuff. At the end of last year, they reached a settlement with Apple where they basically said they do, like, audio and power management stuff. And it was also rumored that Apple's working on its own power management chips. And at the end of last year, Apple announced that they'd reached a deal with Dialog, which I think was valued at $600 million, to basically hire all of Dialog's employees and get, like, their patents and stuff and for... To basically subsume them, basically pay off Dialog, who they used to use for power management, to make them happy, to make them whole for the time when Apple actually switches mm-hmm. to using their own custom power management chips.
And they've spent time over the past few months hiring key Intel modem engineers to work for Apple. They've been working on their own thing for a while. They settled with Qualcomm so that they can use Qualcomm for 5G for the next few years and then have their own thing in the future. It seems like to me, like, maybe it's less about you want everyone on the team because they've been hiring key people anyway. Intel's announced we're out of that business. Maybe it's a lot to do with we don't want someone else to hire, like, buy all this stuff up. Like, you know, it keeps it off the market if Apple buys it. Not that they'll immediately benefit from it because they can already get a lot of the way there through poaching, and they have people working on it on their own. And also Intel's modem business wasn't very good. It seems like that's why it goes away. So it isn't like they're, like, buying the best modem business and now they can take on Qualcomm if they can complete the acquisition. So maybe in my mind, I'm thinking about it. It's like, it's to keep all that stuff off the market, prevent, I don't know, Amazon or Samsung or even Facebook or something from making their own modems in a way that you know, I guess benefits them. So
yeah, it's probably, like, best seen as, like, another feather in the bow. Like, Apple mm-hmm. was going to make their own modems anyway.
Yes.
Even if Intel carried on making chips, they were going to leave them, and then you'd have Intel, Qualcomm, and Apple. And as it turns out, Intel's done with it too. So maybe they can get some, you know, some talent, some technology, some research and development stuff, and, you know, a big pile of patents in a nice, like, cheap, for a relatively cheap amount of money.
Yep. All right, let's talk about some hardware rumors. Apple Watch, again, this is funny because there are so few Apple Watch rumors for this year. It's down to a single rumor that might not be a new version this year, like we discussed at the top of the show. We also expect sleep tracking to maybe come to the 2020 Apple Watch, so that's Series 5 if that happens, or that would be Series 6 if we get new one this year. What else is rumored for next year, not this year?
Yeah, again, this is another hint that the micro LED work that Apple's been working on. Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal have talked about this before, where, you know, Apple's looking to replace OLED displays in its products in the future with a technology called micro LED, which is similar to OLED, but not organic, which which means that it has better durability, it lasts longer, and it's more power efficient, essentially. And I think the panels can be thinner too when on micro LED.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get confused with what the Apple Pro Display XDR uses. That's mini LED, which is like a half step towards micro LED. Micro LED is non-existent in consumer devices today. It basically requires so many individual, like, diodes and pixels that it's only been made in any sort of volume in, like, post-champ size displays. Apple is known to be working on their own micro LED display. I believe Bloomberg at the time kind of quoted, like, a 2023 time frame for 2020, like 2022, 2023. There was a Chinese media report this week that suggested that Apple was working with some Taiwanese suppliers to actually ramp up production for an Apple Watch size display in 2020, which would be sooner than we expected. It's still a bit tenuous, but, you know, possible that the late fall 2020 Apple Watch would feature a micro LED display rather than the OLED panel, which all the Apple Watch use today. And the OLED in the watches is slightly different to OLED used in the phones. The phone displays are made by Samsung. The watch OLED is made by LG currently. So it would switch from an LG OLED panel to a micro LED panel manufactured by these Taiwanese companies that apparently have had some breakthroughs in the last few months, and Apple is very interested in partnering up with them.
Interesting. And maybe that can contribute to the watch getting a bit thinner, not dramatically thinner, but
or improving battery life for like a sleep tracking.
Sure, using the thinness gains to pack more in the same casing body. Yeah.
Yep.
Makes sense. And then this story is a weird one because I thought we were all on the same page with this one, but we've been expecting this 16-inch MacBook Pro to come out in this fall or next spring, or maybe in the winter sometime in between. And because the MacBook Pro 13 and 15 are updated this year, it seems like they're not going to replace the 15-inch Mac Pro with this 16-inch MacBook Pro, but it's just a look at the highest end of the 15-inch MacBook Pro, go above that, and that's where this next one starts out at, or something around that ball field. Today is a story that seems to be surprising everybody, but it's that the MacBook Pro 16-inch will probably start around $3,000. And I kind of thought that was everyone's consensus already.
If you believe that it's not going to replace the 15-inch, which I think was pretty obvious given they revved the 15-inch in May, then it would have to come in at a higher price point, right? Because they're not going to do it cheaper. And the 15-inch starts at like $2,400. So you add on a bit and you get to, $3,000 essentially. Mm-hmm. Like it just kind of seems obvious, but everyone seems to be freaking out that it's so expensive.
Yeah, and I know in 2016 I spec'd my 15-inch MacBook Pro to $3,000, and that was, I think, the only thing I changed from the base model was going up to 1 terabyte SSD, and that at the time that was $3,000. So it's not insane for that, like, a professional high end Apple laptop to cost that, and back then, like, that was only 3 years out from the relatively new $3,000 Mac Pro, which had like no display and accessories, so you'd add all that. Now Mac Pro is even more, displays even more, and it feels like it just kind of fits in with the existing lineup as a, if you want higher end MacBook, we're going to make one. It's going to cost more too. So I think this is probably correct and predictable too.
Yeah, and who knows what the base config of this 16-inch will be. If they give it 512 gigs of storage, for instance, then it's quote-unquote only, $200 more expensive than the 512 gig configuration of the 15-inch MacBook Pro, which is $2,799. So, in some ways, you could see it as good value because you're also getting, bigger screen and presumably a body redesign, new keyboard, blah, 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 blah.
We both know it'll come with 120 gigabyte SSD, though, right?
The MacBook Pros, the 15-inch is 256.
So it's going to be...
So maybe it'll be 256.
Like, well, the iMac Pro is 1 terabyte and the Mac Pro is 128, right? So I think this is going to be 64 gigabytes. It comes with enough space for the OS, and you have to bring your own storage or anything else. But you can't change it.
If you want to complain about Apple's expensive pricing, go ahead. I'm not beating down anyone for that. Their stuff is expensive and in some cases too expensive. But based on what we know already, it should not be a surprise that a 16-inch MacBook Pro that is a higher-end model of a 15-inch MacBook Pro comes in at $3,000.
Mm-hmm. So this is probably one that's correct. Tell me about this 5-nanometer 2020 iPhone chip story rumor.
Yeah, I think there was actually a report around April as well that basically said this even more directly.
Yeah.
For 2019, the A13 chip would use 7-nanometer with some extra lithography stuff, because basically last year's chip was 7-nanometer. Apple made a big deal about being, shipping 7-nanometer volume. This year's chip is expected to be 7-nanometer still, but on a slightly more advanced process that maybe enables Apple to do some more clever things at the like micron level about arranging stuff. And then next year, TSMC, which is obviously what Apple uses to manufacture its A series chips, is going to be ramping up its 5-nanometer fabrication line, which presumably Apple would adopt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you want to have this is just going off guesswork now, right? But if Apple wants to deliver strong performance gains, they can either redesign the architecture or go to a smaller process, right? Obviously, with a smaller fabrication feature size.
Yeah.
You know, that's simplifying a lot. But if you just take those two extremes, this year, it sounds like the feature size isn't changing. So it's likely that we will see a more dramatic redesign of the actual board, right? So when someone x-rays the A13 chip, it'll probably look very different to the A12 chip, mm-hmm. assuming it does actually bring, you know, the kind of performance gains we come to expect now from Apple silicon. And then next year, they might just carry on with like a slightly tweaked version of this year's architecture, but at a 5-nanometer process, which allows them the efficiency gains. That is kind of like the guesswork there.
Yeah. And so are they going at a pace where, you know, every 2 to 3 years you cut down on 2 nanometers, which is a very small measure? Is that about right?
Yeah.
And so at that rate, you go maybe from 5 to 3. I don't know how far you can go beyond that.
I believe this is a big point of argument in the I don't know, nanoscience community.
Yeah.
People don't believe that you'll be able to get past 3 nanometers around that range, because at that point you basically come to like the quantum level and atom stocks, you know, misbehave badly.
Okay.
So they're basically uncontrollable. So once you get down to that level, we're probably going to have a massive change in how these chips work and like actually go to like a quantum computing model type of thing. I'm not an expert in this area, but that's, you know, the summary is that we're not going to be able to go 2 nanometers forever. They're going to hit a hard cutoff. And some of this is marketing, right? Like, I think Intel's 10 nanometer is equivalent to TSMC's 7 nanometer. So there's a bit of, you know, wiggle room there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, if we get to 5 next year, maybe there'll be one more improvement. But beyond that, they're going to have to need something more radical.
Yeah, I wondered if the change would be you go like 5 to 3, and then you obviously can't have a 0 nanometer chip or negative numbers. So it's just that you change the interval instead of by a leap of 2 nanometers. It's, you know, half or a quarter or an eighth, but that it's still measurable, and you change the unit to make it seem larger, like whatever's smaller than a nanometer, whatever a quarter nanometer or eighth of a nanometer is, that would be the new metric that we use for measuring. So, yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting to think about with quantum computing. I'm going to need a bigger leap to go forward there.
Yeah, maybe electrical engineers listening to this show are like screaming at me right now, but I think that's right. Like, once you get into that, so when everything's so close together, atoms just stop behaving in a logical way, and they just start interfering with each other in crazy different ways. So you get like quantum leap and quantum morphing, and all, it's really, really weird and wacky. So
I love it.
They're going to have to do something radically different.
Okay, I love it. Now let's talk about Guy Rambo's exclusive report for 925 Mac about the iPhone 11, which in his reporting, he sees evidence that iPhone 11 will indeed be the name. I want to touch on that a bit. So we see iPhone 11 as like the family name. So it's we have the iPhone 10, the iPhone 10s family, which is the 10s and 10s Max, and there's also 10R in there. I was wondering, like, what do you do when you have 11, 11 Max, and then what do you call the 10R replacement? Do you go to the R for 11R? Okay, that's fine. What do you do next year when you have 11s? 11s Max, and do you do 11RS? You know, it gets clunkier than it already is. But I kind of answered my own question with, well, the rumors point to this year being kind of a repeat of the 10 design, and so it's a revision of that. The 10S was like that, just like the 6S to 7. You did that big name jump there, but it was a revision of the previous year. But 2020 iPhone seemed like there will be different screen sizes at least. And so there'll be some visual differences there. So you could say, this is the iPhone 12 and you don't have the 11RS problem because you have the 11R to the 12R or however they want to brand these in the future. That's kind of my guess, is that you go from 11 to 12, just like you went from 7 to 8 and then 8 to 10, which is a weirder thing. But it's like the
6S, 7... jump, right? Like the 7 design was not crazily different to the 6S, right? It wasn't miles apart.
Yeah, and neither was the 8, and you went 7 to 8, and you could have called the 8 the 7S, but, you know, it's all branding, so it didn't...
Yeah, so you take the 10S, mm-hmm. which is the 6S, then you have the 7, which is the 11, and then you have the 8, which is the 12.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And that cleans up the whole, you never need an 11RS at that point, and it can just be 11R and 12R. And then maybe down the road, you come up with a new scheme. Maybe you don't go to 13, even though we can do it with iOS. We'll see. That's one thing. And then there are also code names revealed in this story. These are always the kind of like D and then a number identifiers, or in the case of the 10R, I think it's an N identifier. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's two more things that I find especially interesting and brand new from this report. One's the mention of Leap Haptics, and one's the mention of Smart Frame. So what are those?
Yeah, Leap Haptics sounds like a new generation of Taptic Engine. Who knows if like Leap Haptics is what then they'll brand it as. It might just be like the internal name. Mm-hmm. It's not clear what the difference would be in this Taptic Engine compared to the previous one, but obviously we've seen a lot of changes with 3D Touch, and originally 3D Touch was introduced alongside the Taptic Engine, provide that, you know, feedback that feels connected to your gesture.
Yeah.
Maybe this Taptic Engine can provide some different kind of vibrations for whatever the iPhone 11 model is, which we believe will be like closer to haptic touch. Maybe it will offer just some different kind of vibrations for different things and a wider range of feedback compared to what you can do today with the Taptic Engine. Although today you can actually do quite a lot with the Taptic Engine that Apple doesn't take advantage of in the system. And with iOS 13, Apple for the first time will let third-party developers make custom tones to play on the haptic engine. So actually this fall we might see some more adventurous stuff where it's not just like single like impact vibrations. You can actually like almost like how you can make ringtones that, you know, vibrate in a certain way. Developers can actually make haptic patterns now in iOS 13. And it's almost like, you know, almost too coincidental for that also to come with a revision to the Taptic Engine itself. So you might find that it's just like more well-defined, more, you know, you can do wider ranges of patterns, wider ranges of force, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And then Smart Frame. So the big rumor with the iPhone 11 this year is that you go from two cameras at most to having three. And one of those, I think might have been Mark Gurman at Bloomberg who was first reported that one of those will be ultra wide, rather than like going from 2x to a higher optical zoom. They're going to use it for ultra wide, which is like what Samsung does on the S10. And Gurman said that it would be used so that you could correct some images, that it'd be, even if you shot on the regular 1x camera, you could use the ultra wide data to crop outward. So if there's something that you missed in the shot that you think is interesting, you could put it back in the frame. But we didn't get the Smart Frame kind of camera feature, and there's some more to it. So Gurman also had the, I think Live Photos doubles the length, and you can do some interesting things with that. But what Rambo is saying is that you'll also be able to like just to crop images, and I think video, he says too, using that Smart Frame feature when you're not shooting an ultra wide artistically different image or video. Then there's also a benefit to just your traditional pictures, which is cool. And then a new angle on that also is that the data is saved temporarily, but it's automatically deleted. That extra data that you didn't take in your picture, it's almost like if Live Photos, you had to opt into it being a live photo. You know, you can turn it on and off, but like if by default it lost the video unless you said keep it. In this case, it'll keep the ultra wide footage or shot, unless you crop and, you know, take advantage of that space. And then after a certain period of time, the extra data goes away, unless it's an ultra wide picture, that's all in the frame.
Yeah. So it sounds like it can somehow fuse. So you're taking a picture with a telephoto angle, and then it can fuse in data from the ultra wide camera and like fit it around it. So the thing I always think of, if you take a picture off angle and you want to do perspective correction on the current iPhones today, you know, you can't rotate without causing black bars, so they have to also crop in.
Mm-hmm.
And what this combination of ultra-wide data would seemingly provide in the Smart Frame stuff is that when you do that perspective correction, it will just be able to bring in more of the, you know, ancillary sides from the ultra-wide image, and therefore you're not having to zoom in as much.
Yeah, I
just twist.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are excited by this report and excellent reporting from Guy Rambo on 9to5 Mac. Like people are getting excited for this as an upgrade feature, and you could totally see this as a differentiation from what you're seeing from other phone makers. You can totally see a new haptic engine being a big part of the keynote, because they love to talk about the internals and what's changed. And it lines up with so much that's been reported. One last question. What's your latest best guess at what the 11R camera will feature? Because we all believe now it will have the big square bump, but only two lenses. What's your latest best guess at what those will be?
Yeah, I reckon it will be wide angle, so the default 1X camera, and ultra wide. So then they can do this kind of smart framing stuff on the 11R as well.
Yeah, which is different from what you'd see if you just brought the 10S camera to the 11R and you had a dual camera. You just caught up with last year's phones. It might be that they do something, more in between. Let me take one break here. I gotta answer this phone call.
All right.
If I can find my iPhone. Hello?
Hey, is it Zachary?
Yep.
Hey, this is Ashley from Classic Chat. I was just going to let you know that your course has been finished.
Okay, cool. How long are y'all open for tonight?
As long as it doesn't, the rain doesn't, bottom out, we'll stay open till 6.
Till 6? Okay, I'll be there before then. Yep.
All right.
All right, thanks. All right, done with that.
You're so funny. You immediately transition to your southern y'all when you're on the phone.
Ah, I didn't even notice. And also, go check out 9to5 Mac Stack Trace podcast with Guy Rambo and John Sandel. They get way more in the weeds on developer stuff than we do. Mayo is a developer, but I'm not, and so I don't have that curiosity. But they get into that stuff, and I imagine this week especially they'll have more information about Rambo's report and maybe even some behind the scenes how things came about. So check that out. And also, there's a change to Overcast and the recommendation engine within the Overcast podcast player, which I imagine a lot of our listeners use. I use Apple's podcast app, but I think I might be in the minority as a tech enthusiast who uses the podcast app. But in Overcast, the recommendation engine, I think, used to be built on Twitter and people sharing shows. A bit of that. Twitter integration has been totally removed from Overcast, and it's now based mostly on when you tap the, what is it, a star?
Star.
Yeah, to recommend an episode. So the idea is that the user base of Overcast has grown over the last 4 years or so. A small minority even use the Twitter feature where you just looked at what your friends on Twitter are recommending. And now it's what is everyone on Overcast recommending with some intelligence behind that. And so for that reason, we ask you to tap that star in Overcast to recommend Happy Hour and all of 9to5 Mac podcasts, because it will increase the discoverability of our podcasts in Overcast, which is always appreciated. Anything to add to that?
Like, comment, and subscribe. Oh, wait, we're not YouTube.
Yeah. And also, if you use Apple's podcast app, we always appreciate a written review or just a star recommendation. You can rate, I think, on a 1 to 5 star scale in Apple's podcast app.
Rate, review, and star.
There you go. And if you're a new listener, subscribe. You get new episodes every week when you subscribe. If you're a longtime subscriber, we thank you, because we really love doing the show together. We love growing the show together. And it's been a fun journey so far.
Indeed.
Yeah. Indeed. Last week, I snuck in there this mention about using the hashtag Ask9to5Mac on Twitter to submit Q&A for the podcast for the first time ever. And the funny kind of backstory there is that, Mayo, you're not a big fan of Q&A on podcast.
and you kind of set me on that one.
Yeah, and because the lawn people were mowing my lawn last week, I had to re-record the ending anyway. And I meant to say it, but I just didn't have it in the notes so that you wouldn't see it. And I forgot to say it. So when I re-recorded the ending, the sign off last week, I remembered to mention it. And you saw on Twitter the first person using it. And you said, oh, listeners are making a thing on their own. And I was like, not quite.
So I'm not a super big fan of Q&A, but. I'm happy to try it out. Yeah, and so far, we've actually got some pretty cool questions.
Yeah, we've got around a dozen or more questions so far. And so this is going to be useful for next week, because I think it's the first week of August or the last week of July. I'm going to be out of town in, I think it's Naples, Florida, South Florida on the west side. just visiting family for a vacation. I'll be working, but it'll be kind of a getaway week two. But I won't be in the ideal environment to record a podcast. So this week, we're going to record next week's episode this week. And so we'll have those questions to help us do some interesting show. And for everyone who submitted with Ask9to5Mac, hashtag Ask9to5Mac on Twitter, I thank you, because I think we're getting some really cool questions. One even made us spend like 30 minutes Googling our history together before the show started today, which like wasted our time, but it's going to be a fun
we'll
answer
talk
next
about
week.
It. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, it'll be there next week. So thanks for everyone who's submitting questions so far. And one last thing I'll say for this week is 9to5Mac has been trying to hire a night editor, to write the news and edit stories in the evening time. We've had someone in this role, Chance Miller, for a long time. He graduated college recently. Congratulations, Chance. And so now he's looking to have hours. He's been working hours more during the daytime. And so we kind of have a gap in the evening. So we're looking for somebody for this role. It's not, you know, I think the pay is if you want to get interested, you know, get a foot in the door in the tech publishing world. I think it's ideal for that. The hours, I think, they're later in the day because of the necessity of the job. So if you're in a non-US time zone, it's especially ideal. Chance wasn't in a non-US time zone and he made it work. So reach out to chance@9to5mac.com over email, or Chance H. Miller on Twitter if you want to ask about that role. We've spent a few months trying to find the right person, and it's a little bit harder than we expected. So, I'm bringing the job call to the podcast. So thanks for that. And with that being said, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach, and Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo,
and follow 9to5Mac at 9to5Mac on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.